And welcome to the program, Sam Rzhovsky on Sam Nation Talk Radio, 790 KBC. And happy Sunday. I hope you guys have had a great weekend. Missy, how's yours doing? Good? You hanging in there? Well, yeah, I love my crew. You know, I'm so grateful. They come in here on the weekends. They see to it that everything gets done. Very grateful. Good thing, too, there is an important service that needs to be done on these airwaves. Someone's got to do it. Now, there's a lot of questionable programming on the weekend. Well, not all of it, but some of the other stations. You know, they've got some. The weekends are always just dull. What I always wanted as a listener was to have a place to go at the end of the week where I'd get a good roundup on the major issues, where it was actual and real time. And I could go to talk politics instead of, cooking and, mortgages and that kind of thing. So, you're in the right place. 6 p.m. Sundays, KBC. Good stuff. So now, yesterday, if you'd missed the show, we went into Milwaukee, and I'm going to go back to that a little bit because what I missed talking about yesterday was the New York City thing, okay? And New York is such a great example of how failed left-wing policies create misery for lower-income Americans. And it's not just for blacks, it's also for whites, it's for Hispanics, but by and large, it really does disproportionately end up affecting blacks. And I want to talk about that. But I want to first talk about in this show today is I want to get to a little bit of a campaign update. And if you follow the program, you know that I really feel that Trump for about a week and a half there. So it would have been at the end of last week is when I really lamented it, is it seemed to have been losing his way. And what was going on behind the scenes to explain some of his craziness is look, first of all, Trump is a political novice. 100%. Now, he's not new to TV. He's not new to media. In fact, in a lot of respects, he's in the exact opposite of your average first time presidential contender. Now, I say presidential contender because this is really important. Many times when you have a first-time presidential contender, and it could be, Bill Clinton, okay? George W. Bush, just to name two. And you have, there are people that are, both of those candidates had really already made their political chops. Clinton in Arkansas, and Bush in Texas. These are people who had won some races and they lost some races. Now, what they didn't necessarily have is they came onto the scene as serious presidential contenders in their respective primaries. And for the first time, they have national media attention. But they have years and years and years behind them of political savviness, political experience, and I'll add one more thing. I think this is really important. Political infrastructure. Okay? Now, so it's like anything in life. If you start a business and you start the business, your first year, you are going to do stupid stuff. Guaranteed. Any job. Remember when you started your last job and you're there, it's the first time. And so that's it. It's a big... There's a learning curve, but in a business sense, I'll tell you, in a business sense, this is more important. I think it's a better analogy. When you start a business, no business succeeds necessarily in a vacuum. You need to rely on certain infrastructure. You need to have the right vendors. You need to find the right employees. You need to find the right managers. I know this. I've built a business from the ground up. I know what this is like. You've got to build infrastructure. And to get to that infrastructure, And human capital is the hardest infrastructure, by the way. Can I tell you this? Human capital, fancy way of saying employees, that is the hardest part of the business to develop. And those of you who know me know that to get to where I am today and the 65 odd people in my organization that work for me, that took years of refining, of hiring, of firing, of rehiring, of training to get there. And it's a process that's continuing as we speak. So even for an accomplished organizational guy like Trump, meaning he, you know, whether you like his company or not, he has organizational capability. He knows how to hire and fire. He knows how to develop people. He knows how to build an organization. And he's got a lot of employees. A guy like Trump is totally new to the political scene. Somebody tells him, hey, this campaign manager, that campaign manager, this guy, that guy, that girl, that whatever. And his campaign, he's only a year into this. I don't want you to think that I'm just, you know, a Trump apologist, but I'm here to objectively explain this and to give you some context for what is going on. If you had a business that had started a year ago and had stumbled through a few, or maybe even a couple, let's just say couple, keep it analogous, a couple reorganizations, and the business was actually getting a sizable portion of market share in its first year, even though nobody had considered that business to be viable in its particular area, no business magazine would look at that and say, oh, that what a bunch of losers. That's terrible. They're reorganizing. In fact, if you read about this story in the Wall Street Journal or Forbes or whatever, they would applaud those changes, those successive reorganizations, as a sign that the business was willing to do what was necessary in order to advance, to move forward, to refine itself, to grow. But all of a sudden, and this, I think, to some extent, being product of on one hand, a biased media and certainly a media who has no idea how an organization runs, they're looking at Trump reorganizing his campaign management as a sign of weakness. You know, I'm reminded, do you remember who Al Gore had as his campaign manager? Donna Brazile. Now, she was terrible. That's right. She was terrible. Awful. And one of the, if in, in the postmortem, one of the reasons why Gore lost. Now, Gore knew she was terrible leading into the finish. But someone in the know, and maybe even his own political instinct, because mind you, Gore at this time is an experienced political operative. Not just an 8-year veteran of the Clinton White House, but he's also a Tennessee, what was he, a senator? Or was he a governor? I think it's senator. But at any rate, he was an experienced politician. And Gore made the terrible mistake. He was worried about the optics of it. He was worried what would happen if I drop my campaign manager in the fourth quarter. I'm going to look like the wheels are coming off my campaign. And Trump, being a business guy, is saying, I don't care what it looks like. I need to reorganize. My campaign's not doing well. Here's the deal. Trump reorganized. And he did it. I'll go back a little bit. In the primaries, he had a capable guy, Corey Lewandowski. Now, Corey was what we know about him. I mean, he was not an experienced high-end political operative. But what he was is he was a fearless guy, and he was ideologically wedded to Trump That's important. In any organization, you have to have people that believe in your cause. They have to believe in it fundamentally. Now, Trump brought in the last reorg, when Lewandowski got cut, Corey got cut, and Paul Manafort was brought in. Manafort was brought in to smooth things over with the establishment and to line up all the people needed in order to get, yes, to get the delegate math together. Okay, so if you're just tuning in, what we're talking about here is Trump's big reboot and trying to explain the context of everything. You've got to go back to the first one. And Manafort fulfilled a purpose. In fact, I think he fulfilled it fairly well. Smooth things over with the establishment. He got all the delegate math together, got Trump to the convention. And then a problem came to be. And this problem is not one that could easily be overcome. And this problem would have been fatal, absolutely fatal to Trump's campaign. You could see it was happening. And when we come back, what I want to do is I want to explain to you what this fundamental problem with Paul Manafort was and how it almost derailed the Trump train. Sam Rzhovsky, Sam Nation Talk Radio, 790 KABC.
In this present crisis, government is the solution to our problem. Government is the problem, and Sam Nation is the solution. Of course, you need jelly beans for that.
And we're back. Sam Rzhovsky, Sam Nation Talk Radio, 790 KBC, talking about the Trump campaign reboot. And I was explaining why in any other situation, especially a business context, a commercial context, a reboot is a good thing. And explaining that Trump, is a candidate who is brand new to this. So it's a little bit upside down compared to other people. You generally have people who go into elections, a national election, a presidential election. George W. Bush, Clinton, this kind of person who goes into it for the first time, neither of whom had served as a vice president before. They go into it. And what they do have is they've got a political infrastructure. They have people, they have campaign managers that they have relied on for a long time. What they don't have, of course, is Trump has been used to being a national media guy. I mean, he knows how to talk on TV. He knows how to be entertaining. He knows that side of it. So he's almost the upside down of what we usually see. We usually have candidates who have a very established, already formed political machine and are getting their sea legs talking on national media, because previously the most scrutiny they got was, in Texas or Arkansas or whatever their home state is. And that's an important point, because you take Sarah Palin, for example, who just completely short-circuited on national TV. Just was not used to that kind of scrutiny. She was a candidate that played very well going from state fair to state fair, but not, and on Alaska TV, but was not someone who was ready for primetime. But this reboot is being framed as, I'll tell you what happened. Trump announced this week that, or last week, I should say now, announced that Paul Manafort was going to be just the campaign chairman. And he brought in a new leader for the campaign, and that is the Breitbart CEO, Steve Bannon. He also promoted a woman who is now the number two in the campaign. And actually, it's the first female to run a GOP White House effort. The media's not said anything about that. Just kind of passed off on that point. Because you know what? Just like with Black Lives Matter that we talked about yesterday, it's all about the emotion and not about the facts. Well, the narrative that plays is Trump's a woman hater, right? He has a problem with women. So if that's the narrative, we can't talk about any facts that would disrupt that narrative. At least those are the discussions happening deep within CNN newsrooms. So what happened is, I'll tell you why Paul Manafort had to go and why we probably are going to see him even more marginalized and even more sidelined in the campaign. Manafort is an establishment guy who played an establishment role and at a very important time when Trump needed to make the political thing work for him. He needed to get the delegates. He needed to get them together. He needed to get the bound and unbound people. And he had to put together a package that was going to get him through the convention and get him the nomination. I think that Lewandowski might not have gotten Trump across that finish line. Lewandowski was and is, remains so, a very loyal Trump person. He is a Trump loyalist and always was. But he didn't have the connections with the establishment. He was much more of a rabble-rousing pirate than an establishment whisperer. Manafort is an establishment whisperer. But he is the worst kind of Republican there is. He's the kind of, he represents everything that is complete lose-lose on the Republican side. He's an establishment guy. What does he do? What does he do? What do we know about him? He is a lobbyist. That's right. He's a lobbyist. He is a guy who, in other words, uses politics for profit. He can't win the argument on the argument against Hillary is that she has used at every turn politics for profit. It is one of the most devastating arguments and arguments. It's one of the most devastating things to lob at her. And you can't, and ideologically, you can't have the heart and soul of the campaign. Well, Trump is the heart and soul of the campaign, but you can't have his top deputy be somebody that has totally and completely sold out himself to establishment politics for personal gain. Can't have it. And what I believe was happening behind the scenes, and certain sources have confirmed this to me, is that there was a growing tension between Manafort and Trump over these issues. Trump is trying to hit Hillary on certain things. He says, don't do it, don't back off. And then at a certain point, there's a critical storm because you start to have this thing brewing with Manafort and the money that he got from Ukraine. And if you miss the story, the only thing that's really relevant to it is that he took an obscene amount of money from a bad guy in Ukraine who has Putin ties. And so what you have is you've got a guy who's lobbying our government on behalf of a foreign government. And the whole argument against Hillary is that you can't have a Secretary of State in office. It's, of course, much less removed than the Paul Manafort thing because Manafort wasn't an elected official. But CNN won't report it that way. Heck no. No chance in hell. How it gets reported is, oh, it's parody. Look, I mean, you know, Manafort does this, you know, Hillary does this. This is how politicians are. Trump's going to do it. Once he gets into office, you know, he's going to look at all the people he's surrounding himself with. So at a crucial time, Trump ideologically is at odds with his campaign manager. And not only that, his campaign manager now is part of the story. And he's part of this, he's going to be used as part of the narrative against him by Hillary Clinton's people. It just is a recipe for disaster. And what we found, and this is what I'm hearing, and I believe it. If you watch that week, you see Trump saying some pretty crazy things and going off script. What it is a guy frantically trying to save his own campaign, feeling like he's got to do everything. He's got to plug these holes. You could tell he was angry. Now, a guy like Trump, you don't want to, he's got to have good infrastructure. Good infrastructure means there's people on the back end that are supporting him who are competent and who have his back. And I'll tell you, organizationally, when somebody who supports you has your back, it doesn't just mean that they're there when they say they're going to be there. It means that they are on the same page with you as to the cause that you are both enjoined to advance. And this is the problem. When you have a campaign manager who is not causally with you, then you have someone who doesn't have your back, and it creates it for, especially for a strong leader like Trump, who needs a good infrastructure, you feel like you've got somebody backing you up who doesn't have your back. He did exactly the right thing. He had to make a change. And how do I know all this? Because it's not just through sources. Well, I'll tell you, the proof is in who he picked to be his new campaign manager. Steve Bannon is an ideologue. He is somebody who, he's a Trump prototype. He's somebody who Trump sees eye to eye with. And it's not just because Breitbart has supported Trump and, has been, laughingly called, Trump's auxiliary media outlet. The Breitbart folks are anti-George Bush Republican. Of course they're anti-Hillary, but they're anti-neocon. George Bush, to the Breitbart people, to Steve Bannon, are sellouts. They are absolute political sellouts. They view neocons as total sellouts. And when Trump's entire campaign argument is, hey, you over there, the Democratic Party has sold out on you. Hey, you over there, the Republican Party has sold out on you. He can't bring on as a campaign manager a guy like Manafort, who's a total sellout himself. It just doesn't work. And the fact that he recognized that this is the kind of thing that actually, I'll be honest with you, gets me reinvigorated and excited again about a Trump candidacy. Because the Trump that I saw this last week is a Trump that can win. The Trump last week, this last week, was a Trump that was on message. I saw him in Michigan. Was it in Michigan or Wisconsin? No, it was at the rally in Wisconsin. He telepromptered it. It was succinct. It was clear. And he addressed very difficult subjects in a very concise and clear way. And a lot of the stuff that I talked about that I've always believed, the core argument about poverty and race in America, he said it. He has got to be the first candidate for president, the first major party candidate for president, certainly, who has stood up and called it what it is, which is the left and the black culture itself is to blame for creating this toxic stew of poverty. And it's not because there's a bunch of racist cops out there, white people that want to keep black people down, but it's rather the disintegration of the black family, the disintegration of education because you've got kids that are ungovernable. And it's the left is simply not the answer. So when we come back, I want to talk about New York, because this is really the argument. Trump has seen all this firsthand. Any New Yorker with a brain, pair of eyes, has seen a tale of two cities. So when we come back, I want to talk about that. Sam Rojofsky, Sam Nation, Talk Radio 790 KABC.
You're looking for a show that doesn't sugarcoat the truth. Sam Nation will accommodate you.
Does anyone know how chickens make their way to KFC? Where do you think the chickens at KFC come from? Okay, so Sam Rojofsky, Sam Nation, Talk Radio, 790 KBC. Well, we talk about serious things on this show. I mean, it's not all politics, current events, and the truth. Well, this is the truth. Just not necessarily too political. Well, I would assume that these, I don't know, I assume that chickens are delivered, you know, they're already all cut up, pre-sliced, you know, boned, whatever you do. I mean, they all come ready to the KFC, but apparently, not always. Crates of live chickens appear to have flown off the back of a moving truck and right onto the doorstep of a Kentucky Fried Chicken restaurant outside of Melbourne. That's right. You heard that correctly. Now, what is worse is that the incident was caught on film. And you know what's even worse than that? The filmographer. The eyewitness on the scene, the person who was able to capture this event on her cell phone, is none other than Jessica Carter, avowed vegan. Now, Ms. Carter was walking nearby when she noticed a commotion in Bacchus Marsh, 2 p.m. on Tuesday. She saw injured and dead birds were being crammed into cages while passerbys joked that those who survived would likely have ended up at KFC anyway. Now, Ms. Carter, this, for her, I'll tell you, this does not say how old Ms. Carter is. Although I will tell you from some of these quotes, I suspect she belongs to the snowflake generation. Because for her, this whole incident should have carried a trigger warning. People were joking about it, saying KFC won't have to pluck their chickens, at least not now. She said. Can you hear it? I can hear it. It just highlights to me that people are so indifferent to their suffering, even after they've been through a trauma like that. She then added that nobody was really, this is also a quote, I'm not going to do it in that voice, but nobody was really showing any respect for life. I love liberals, and most of them, all these PETA people mostly are libs. They're probably all, they all probably donate massive amount of money to Planned Parenthood every year, but then complain about how no respect to life is being shown to chickens getting dropped off the back of a truck. It does not say in this article if anybody else, any humans were injured by this incident, but can you, what would you do? What would you do if you're driving along? And all of a sudden, a giant crate of chickens comes flying out of a truck and onto your vehicle. Well, hopefully you're able to swerve safely out of the way. But if not, if you get hit, if you're injured, here's what you got to do. You got to, well, you know, who are you going to call? Attorney James Bergner. That's right. Attorney James Bergner. His friends call him Sweet James, and I'll tell you why. He's a champion for the victor, for you, for the little guy, winning personal injury cases against the big evil insurance companies. And if you think I'm kidding or overplaying this, take it from me, an avowed capitalist. And you know that. I'm a capitalist, and if you listen to the program, you know what we're all about here. But I understand that companies are and should always be allowed to focus on their profits. That's what matters. You know, that's the truth. And insurance companies, their profit comes from collecting premiums and not paying out claims. So what you need when you get into an accident, you've got to call someone to help you. Somebody who's going to be on your side is going to advocate for your recovery. And that one call should go to Attorney Sweet James Bergner, because he's the guy who's going to look after you and make sure that the insurance company pays you what's fair. Now, I was talking to him, and I talked about this yesterday on the show, that there are attorneys that will call you. You know that there's attorneys that will look up car accidents, look up police reports, people have been released from hospitals, and they'll give you a call. Ambulance chasers, that's right. Don't go with a lawyer that calls you. Go with the lawyer that you call. And make that call to Sweet James Bergner. That's right. 1-800-881-2021. 1-800-881-2021. Or visit sweetjames.com. Getting hungry. I think, I know it's Sunday, but maybe a little KFC is in order after the program. Sounds good, doesn't it? What do you think, Robbie? Yeah, you know, it's funny actually, there's this whole, you know, there's a big foodie movement out there right now. It's foodie and drinks, you know, we talk about it. We digress from time to time from serious political themes on this program to discuss cultural movements and ground shifts. But you know, we're definitely in an epoch right now that is food oriented. And it's funny, there's all these bougie places popping up that do fried chicken. And the irony is that KFC and Chick-fil-A still makes, in my opinion, maybe I have an unrefined palate. I'm probably voting for Trump, so that I don't know what that says about my palate. Trump eats KFC. There's pictures of him always on his 757 jet flying around eating KFC. People think it's staged. I'm telling you, I'm with him. I think KFC is good, but it's certainly better than these, you know, bougie places. It's the same thing with burgers, though. You know, it just doesn't get better than a nice, good In-N-Out burger. If you disagree with me, fine. But it's true. Like when I travel, when I leave the country and I come back after a trip, what do I crave? It's always an In-N-Out pit stop. Anyway. Well, they have KFC, but they don't have In-N-Out in New York. And that's New York we want to talk about here for a minute, because if you're tuning in just now, we talked about the campaign reboot, Donald Trump, but we're going to talk a little bit about some of the things that he said in one of the best speeches that he delivered in Wisconsin. I believe it was on Tuesday of last week. It was a terrific speech. And he really tackled the issue of race, of why these riots were happening. And he started the talk off with, "Hey, we got to have a serious conversation about this, and you're not going to like what I have to say." And in the talk, he gets into some of the same things that I've talked about previously on previous shows, and I went into some great detail about it yesterday. If you missed the program, go to samnation.com, get the podcast, please, and review it. You won't be disappointed. But I can tell you right now where Trump is getting his information. And it's, well, you know, it's not Wikipedia. It's from life. And it's from life living in New York. Now, I talked a little bit about this yesterday, and I didn't quite get to the New York example, but rewinding a touch. You have in the 10 most crime-ridden U.S. cities have all been historically run by Democrats. Okay? This is simply a truth that can't be ignored. And I went through some of these cities. Detroit, number one ranked nation's most dangerous city measured by FBI statistics. Oakland, Memphis, St. Louis, Milwaukee, Baltimore, all these places, and they've all been bastions of Democratic control for years and years. And of course, the aside I have is, before I even get into the facts of it and the statistics and all that, if the Democrats want to complain to me and to you about all these problems and all these issues and all these terrible things, come on. Fix it. You guys have been at the levers of power for, in some of these cities, 100 years. In others, for over 50. So if you have progressive politicians running these cities and they're running them into the ground, tell me why. Well, the interesting study here, of course, is New York, which was Democratic controlled until 1990, when there was an epic ground shift and Rudy Giuliani was swept into power. And crime under Giuliani dropped through the floor. I mean, New York. I mean, in the early 1990s was just a terrible place. A terrible place. The murder rate soaring. You know, the city's homicides during the first 3 years of Dinkins' mayoralty. Now, Dinkins was the last Democratic mayor of New York before Giuliani was elected. And homicides were up. I mean, there was something around 2,100 homicides. And then they dipped a little bit. I think it was something under 2,000. And then they went back up. So around, I mean, for 3 years during the time that Dinkins was mayor, 2,000 murders. And now enter Giuliani. Okay, and in 94, quickly things begin to change. He increases the police force from 28,000 officers to something like 40,000, almost doubles it. And he brings in Chief Bratton. And I'm going to talk to you what Bratton does. And I'll explain to you what he does, okay? And it's not being nice and considerate and sweet and taking care and coddling criminals. It is literally the exact opposite of what Black Lives Matter wants. Back after this. Sam Rogowski, Sam Nation, Talk Radio 790 KABC.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, here's Johnny.
Now, as an added spot tonight, I just wanted to let you guys know that we are subjugating our entire show to Sam Nation because apparently he's right and the rest of everyone is wrong.
Hi, Sam Rogowski, Sam Nation, Talk Radio 790 KBC. And we're talking about the inconvenient truths of race, politics, and the Black Lives Matter movement. And we're talking about New York City specifically as a case study of why everything that Donald Trump said last week is absolutely true. Okay, so right before the break, we're talking about how New York murders were soaring up to 2,100 a year under Mayor Dinkins, who was the last Democrat from a long line of Democrats who was mayor in New York. The city was a terrible place to live. It was dirty. It was awful. People like Trump were seeing it firsthand. Okay, they're seeing it firsthand. People are doing drugs in parks. There's prostitution. And what happens is people finally had enough, and shock and surprise and ground shift, 1994, who is elected but Rudy Giuliani? Now, Giuliani at the time ran on a anti-crime platform. He did not run on a, hey, let's all be nice and sweet, and we're going to replace cops' guns with Nerf batons and that kind of thing. No, people in New York had enough, and they wanted a law and order candidate. And Giuliani was a tough prosecutor. He had put away prosecuted some of the top mobsters and such. And so he was the law and order candidate, and he won handily. And what he did was he brought in Chief Bratton. Now, Chief Bratton just barely, I don't want to skip ahead too far in the story, but he's the guy that just got kicked out by Mayor de Blasio, a Democrat. And Bratton has stayed in office from mayor and then to police commissioner this entire time. It's important. And what Bratton did, and this is you might have heard of this, but he was a proponent of this criminology theory that's called broken windows, which is if you allow petty crime to exist, if you allow, let's say, kind of like what happened in Milwaukee here. If you allow Seville Smith to loiter around with a gun in his waistband, he's not threatening anybody with a gun. But if you let him walk around and brandish weapons, and you let them tag buildings, vandalize buildings, you let them steal cigarettes from store clerks, eventually, petty crime leads to major crime. What Bratton did was he went after petty crime, and he went after it hard. Now, a mysterious thing, of course, is that petty crime went down, but not just petty crime, but also major crime. And let's go through those stats. Remember I said last year the Dinkins was in office, homicides were around 2,000 homicides that year? Yeah, mayor's final year, okay, about 2,000 homicides. Then, in 95, homicides dropped to 1,100. Then in 96 to 900. Then the following year to 700. Then to 600. And they stayed at 600 until 2001. And then what happened? Bloomberg, right? Mayor Bloomberg succeeded Giuliani as mayor in 2002 and continued the same strategy. And homicides rates fell even further, down to 587, 597, 570, 539, ended up making New York the safest big city in America. Think about that. Think about that. And guess who benefited the most from this? It's not Trump living in Trump Tower. It's not all the white Jewish liberals living on Madison Avenue. No. Who benefited from these evil Republicans smacking the crap out of gangsters on the street? Minorities. You know who accounted for that 79% drop in homicides? Well, I'll tell you about, well, no, it was more than that, but it was about the total reduction of homicides, the drop in homicides. 80% of that was blacks and Hispanics. So these policies saved overwhelmingly. The overwhelming majority of the lives saved were that of blacks and Hispanics, of minorities. And when I say minorities is an overused term, it wasn't Asians, okay? It wasn't Pacific Islanders. It was traditional, underprivileged, low-income groups whose lives were saved. Think about that. You want Black Lives Matter? You want to talk Black Lives Matter? I'll tell you, this is where Black Lives Matter. Here, 1,000 lives saved under Giuliani and Bloomberg every year. 1,000 black and Hispanic lives saved every year because of strict policing. So my answer to what's going on in Milwaukee is, and what's going on across the U.S., is not we need police that are thoughtful and that are considerate and that are sensitive, and that maybe we need less police so that we're not militarizing neighborhoods. Maybe, just maybe, if Black Lives Matter to you, you should be wanting more police. But that's not convenient to the narrative, is it? So now you'll say, well, Sam, look, what was happening in New York? I mean, that's, you know, because what we're talking about here is, look, you got Democrats in power, murder rates, 2,000 odd people a year. Giuliani comes in, gets tough on crime, gets tough on low-level crime. He introduces something like, I think it was called CompStat, which statistically showed where crime was occurring in areas. And then police, well, they would have meetings. They ran it like a business. You know, hey, here's where we need to devote resources. There's all these crimes occurring in these four square blocks. We've got to get in there and we've got to contain it. And they devote resources to it. And all of a sudden, the murder rate drops to a third, a fourth, you know, from the 2000s to the 500s a year. You say, well, it could have been anything. The economy got better in the 80s. You know, it was other stuff. It wasn't this. Well, let's talk about Mayor de Blasio, who is the biggest freaking moron ever. It takes a lot for me to call a politician a total moron. Bill de Blasio is one of them. He's a total lunatic, left-wing nut loser who is in charge of New York City. I don't know. I'll talk about it next. I'm out of time, but I saw the Wiener documentary about Anthony Wiener when he was running for mayor. I mean, I guess de Blasio just didn't have a lot of competition. So de Blasio becomes mayor. And what does he do? He wages war against the police. He ends stop and frisk. He neuters the police force. He starts reducing the number of police officers on patrol. I mean, he frustrates Bratton to the point where Bratton resigns. And what happens to crime in New York? What has been happening to crime in New York? Murder is up. Robberies, violent robberies are up. And people are shooting up. I just saw a news story in the New York Post. People are shooting up in Washington Square in broad daylight. Bums are urinating in public. Bums are, petty low-level crime brings in higher crime. And the police are being prevented from enforcing low-level crimes under the auspices, the ridiculous left-wing idiocy that you have to be humane and you have to be tolerant and you've got to be understanding. People are committing these crimes. This is a narrative, right? Maybe you have friends that say this kind of thing to you, or you certainly hear it on MSNBC and CNN. You've got to be compassionate. These are less fortunate people. And this is the problem with the left. This kind of fake compassion. This fake compassion does not impact people on Fifth Avenue. I mean, it does a little bit. Muggings are probably up and that kind of thing. But liberal compassion for the poor produces, among other things, this kind of ridiculous theory on policing, which then in turn raises crime levels and raises murder levels. And who gets robbed? Who gets murdered? Is it overwhelmingly the white guy on Madison Ave? The white guy in his penthouse apartment in Manhattan? No, it's poor black people, poor Hispanics, poor, I don't want to use the term, people of color. And this is the greatest lie ever told by the left. Simple. We have compassion. We care. BS. If they really cared, they'd tell you the truth. They'd look you straight in the eyes and tell you that these kind of policies only hurt minorities. And that's where, you know, we talked about the Ford Foundation giving $300 million or whatever it was to Black Lives Matter, $100 million to Black Lives Matter. The number two endowment in the country, the number two charity giving funding, basically a domestic terror group to advance their ridiculous anti-cop agenda, is only going to bring death and destruction to the inner city. I promise that. Because we've already given it up, right? We've already given it up. With welfare, we've destroyed the black family. And so the last line of defense to law and order, to respect, are the police. And this is not an argument to say that there aren't occasional police officers that break the law and they should be tried. They should be obviously fired, tried, imprisoned, and punished for what they do when they do it wrong. But we cannot allow our country to go down this destructive path. So, I'll tell you this. Remember Obama? Easier to buy a Glock than a book? That's the kind of BS I'm talking about. Sam Rojofsky, Sam Nation. Visit samnation.com. That's where you find our email, Twitter, and our Instagram account. Download the podcast, please. And I will see you here next week on Saturday, 3 p.m. Sam Rojofsky, Sam Nation Talk Radio, 790 KABC.